This is WCCO's Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett.
Good morning. We have a great program lined up. Tom Schroyer is our host, Dave Beek in the studio, and we better get busy because we've spent all this time sharing stories about a bowling and Dave Lee's Gutter Bowl event earlier this year, and it's time to move on.
Well, as you know, Steve, Dave contributed materially to our score, and I mean our score, I mean his and mine. We managed, I think, to combine our scores to hit 100 in a few games.
Well, we just didn't want to show off.
Yeah. So welcome back to the show, David Beek. And again, returning with your patent law expertise to share with our listeners. And today we've got a really terrific lineup of news in patent law, both statutory legislative changes, but also a big Supreme Court decision involving our own Mayo Clinic here that we'll get to in a few minutes down the road. But first, let's talk again about patent law. You have more than 20 years of experience, I think 24 years of experience in patent law. You're registered as a patent attorney with the U.S. Patent Office. And, of course, your experience ranges not only from preparing and prosecuting patents, but also litigating them, even to the point of litigating in Europe.
That's correct. It's been a very, very nice varied practice. We also do a lot of transactional type work involving patents, and you know what we find and our clients find is that when you get a patent, there's a lot of different things that you can do with it, and there's a lot of benefits.
Yeah, exactly. David, let's quickly run through the list of what the benefits of a patent are. I know that in my own knowledge base, of course, a patent is something that gives the inventor of a device or a transforming agent the rights to use, market, sell, and license the product for a number of years.
That's right. Once you get the patent issued, you then have a 20-year period in which you have the exclusive right to make, use, sell the invention. And so, therefore, you can exclude others during that time period from making, using, selling the invention. And that's a very, very powerful right held by a patent holder. If you think about an invention, there's a lot of technical risk. There's a lot of commercial risk that is borne by the inventor. And a patent will prevent the copycatters from jumping on board once the invention is successfully exploited and taking that invention for their own.
I want to ask you, jump in quickly as we're going through these benefits of owning a patent. You know, I understand that occasionally someone will get a light bulb idea. You know, a lightning will strike and they'll get an idea and come down to see a patent lawyer and they'll be able to patent their invention. But in truth, isn't it usually the result that a patentable invention is the product of, is the residue, rather, of a lot of hard work and effort?
I think that's certainly true. We all like to daydream that we're going to just come up with that great idea out of left field that is going to make us millionaires, and there are certainly examples of that, but most inventing is done through hard work. It's incremental. It builds upon previous inventions, previous experience, and those are just as worthy of patent protection as that fantastic idea that strikes from left field.
And in addition to the economic benefits then of owning a patent, there are a lot of legal benefits that in turn lead to economic benefits.
Well, that's right. You know, a lot of clients will come to me with a great idea and they'll say, let's patent it because I then want to be able to go out and find a partner, for instance, who is going to put some money in and help me manufacture the product, help me get to the marketplace. And having a patent will put that inventor in a much better position to be able then to deal with that partner, know that that partner is not going to unscrupulously turn down the invention idea. The next thing they know, 6 months later, their invention is on the market, being marketed by this partner who expressed no interest.
So, and that's certainly a risk that might be greater if you're talking about shopping around with trade secrets.
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, when you make the invention, you're going to start out with a body of trade secrets that arise just from the act of inventing. But you have to take affirmative steps in order to maintain those trade secrets. You've got to put secrecy around your invention. You've got to put secrecy around your manufacturing process. You've got to use contracts, confidentiality agreements, when you're talking to other people about your products and inventions. You've got to worry about employees coming and going who may then take your trade secrets with them to your to their next employer. All of that is can be done in principle. You know, there's the Coca-Colas and the Carthusian monks out there who've been very good at keeping trade secrets for hundreds of years, but those are the outliers. And that's another benefit of patents is that you don't have to worry about maintaining the trade secrets that are disclosed in the patent, because now you've got the statutory form of protection.
I'd imagine in terms of marketing it, too, a patent allows you to leverage over a broader territory geographically.
Well, you can, and that's, you know, one of the wonderful benefits, but also the challenge is that a lot of times inventions can be exploited in multiple different territories or multiple different fields. And so perhaps maybe the you know, the inventor wants to exploit it in one area, but he isn't in a position to exploit it in another area. Well, he can go out and find someone else who he can license to use the invention in that second area. And because he has a patent, he can write that license agreement in such a way that he confines the licensee to that second area so that the licensee now isn't competing in the marketplace with the inventor. That's something that would ordinarily might not be possible because you start having antitrust concerns come into play. Well, if you've got a patent, which by its very nature is a right to exclude others from practicing the invention, the government will say, well, that's okay to define markets, if you will, define geographies, because that's better than having the invention not be exploited.
And I imagine along the lines of your discussion about trade secrets being harder to confine and control than a patent, it would also be the case that some inventions, when viewed with hindsight, are seemingly so obvious that perhaps it can be reverse engineered by a competent engineer, let's say, or expert in the field of art, and rendered into a competing infringing product.
Well, right. You know, there are a lot of inventions that just by their very nature, someone who looks at them can figure out how they were made, how to reverse engineer is the terminology we use. And it's going to be very, very difficult to maintain those trade secrets that we talked about a moment ago for that type of invention. Those are the kinds of inventions that may particularly benefit from being patented.
We have more on the way. Patent law changes. Tom Scheuer, Dave Beek in studio today. It is Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett. For more info on today's program, feel free to go online. We have a new website for you, Moss and Barnett on WCCO.com.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Did you know Moss and Barnett attorneys handled the first reported products liability case in the history of Minnesota for a defective tire back in 1967?
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
Minnesota Law returns, News Radio 830 WCCO. Tom Scheuer is our host, Dave Beek in studio. Patent law changes in the spotlight, and you brought up 20 years. Is that true with all patents, including pharmaceuticals? Because there was a big pharmaceutical that was able to go onto the generic market, and that is the widely popular Lipitor, which... is that how it works with pharmaceuticals as well? Is that the inventor of that particular pharmaceutical holds exclusive rights like Lipitor for about 20 years?
Yes, Steve. For what we call utility patents, which is basically anything that's going to cover a product or a process, it's 20 years from the original filing date of the application going forward. And you know, the entire pharmaceutical industry runs on patents. They've got enormous costs of development and costs of regulatory, and they really then will milk that exclusive patent term for every single day. And there's even a law that allows them in some circumstances to extend that patent term to make up for some of the delays that were occasioned by the regulatory process. Now, the only patents that aren't 20 years are what we call design patents that cover ornamental features of a product as opposed to the functional features, and those will be 14 years.
Now, has that law been true for a number of years, the 20-year demarcation line for patent enforceability?
It's been true since 1995. That was when we changed over from 17 years after grant to 20 years after filing. We made that change to harmonize U.S. law with the rest of the world, and we then ever since have had a system where all of the patents that were pending or had issued prior to 1995 got the benefit of the two different schemes, whichever gave you a longer time period. Interestingly, we're just finally now getting to a point where all those patents are expiring, so we're not going to have to worry about figuring out under two different schemes when a patent is going to expire.
Oh, very complicated. We had quite an exciting development, at least locally, in patent law this week when the Mayo Clinic's case involving Prometheus Labs was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court on March 20, last Monday.
Tuesday. Right. You know, this is an exciting case in no small part because it involves one of our hometown companies here, Mayo Clinic down in Rochester. And this is an important case. It is a unanimous case from our Supreme Court, which doesn't happen very often.
I was going to say, how often is our Supreme Court issuing unanimous opinions?
Assuming they all show up, not very often.
And with no split opinions in terms of separately authored concurring opinions. It was all one opinion.
That's right. And that's even more unusual. And I think what it shows is that this was a case with a particular set of facts where there really was widespread agreement by the nine justices of the court. And it is another case that helps to answer the question of for method patents how close can you get to patenting a law of nature without going too far?
Maybe for our listeners, just describe what the invention was described as, what it did that was at stake here.
Well, this was a diagnostic method for a drug called thiopurine that is given to patients in order to help treat autoimmune diseases. So this didn't cover the drug itself, which would be patentable. It didn't cover the method of treating a patient with thiopurine, which would be patentable. This was a diagnostic method to help a doctor figure out whether he was giving too high of a dose or too low of a dose of the drug to the patient.
How did it work?
Well, the drug, when it's in the body, will be just naturally metabolized by the body into metabolites. And there was a big body of science that had established what was kind of your safe range or your ideal range, if you will. Too high, you now start having toxic side effects. Too low, the drug just isn't effective. And what Prometheus tried to do here was they tried to get a claim, and they actually did get a claim.
And you mean they got a patent?
I'm sorry. They got a patent which had a claim which basically just said the following. Administer the drug to the patient. Determine the level of the metabolite in the patient's bloodstream, and then take into account that if the metabolite level is above a certain amount, let's say X, you need to lower the dosage. If it's below a certain level, let's say Y, you need to increase the dosage. And the Supreme Court took a look at that and said, look, you can't patent laws of nature. And that's what just the natural process in the body of metabolizing a drug into metabolites is. So you can't patent the metabolic process, so to speak.
But if they'd had a particularly unique way to test for the metabolics the metabolic levels, that would have been a different issue.
Right. That would have been a different issue. And that's a good point, Tom, is that evidently in this case, the methods used to determine the level of the metabolites in the system, that was all old stuff. That was all in what we call the prior art. So there was nothing new there. So, you know, the court said, and this law has been on the books for a while, that the only way to have patent-eligible subject matter would be to take that that law of nature, so to speak, and then wrap around it some structure which is patentable, and then you've got an invention. So let me just give you an example that maybe would be a little easier to understand.
You know what? Let's hold that for after the break, and we'll come back to more on Minnesota law about the recent patent law decision involving our own Mayo Clinic.
All right, Tom Schroyer, Dave Beek in studio. By the way, phone numbers on the program. If you have questions about patent law, feel free to weigh in. Our phone number is 651-989-9226. Toll free 1-866-989-9226 is the phone number. Text the studio as well, 81807. That's 81807. And that is powered by Home Service Plus, an offering of CenterPoint Energy. Here on News Radio 830 WCCO. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. And a friendly reminder, if you want more information on today's show or any of our other programs, we have a website for you, Moss and Barnett on WCCO.com. Tom Schroyer hosting Dave Beek today. Patent law changes in the spotlight, and you're always welcome to text the program. 81807 is the way to do that. 81807, and that is powered by Home Service Plus. We have phone numbers as well, 651-989-9226, toll-free, 1-866-989-9226. Let's start this segment of the program with a phone call. Julie, you're on the air with Tom and Dave. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Say, I'm hoping you can point me in the right direction. This is a little bit different topic that you've been talking about, but For several years, this idea for a television show has just been nagging at me, and it's just in my mind, and I think it's a great idea. They've done something similar, but it was an hour-long drama, and my idea is for a half-hour comedy slash drama. But it was similar, but not precisely my idea. And this prior show was a smash success, but it kind of fizzled after a couple of years. My problem is, like a lot of people, I'm very broke. I'd have to find an attorney that would say, well, we'll take the profit from the pilot or, you know, if it was a success or something. But I heard when I was investigating some years ago that you have to patent your concept for your show. And I'm wondering if you could point me in the right direction.
Well, Julie, thanks for the question. You know, I'm not exactly sure what the concept is, and I'd like to have you not disclose it on the air, or then you're going to for sure lose your trade secrets. But I'm not exactly sure that this is something that would really lend itself towards patenting. This might be more of a copyright issue where you've got a particular theme or a particular plot idea for a show that would lend itself really more to copyright protection than patent protection.
You know, that's where I would have gone with that question or with the answer as well, Dave, is that it's not an invention per se. It's rather an idea, and that the form in which the protection takes is to protect the manner of expressing the idea via the copyright laws and possibly to trademark up the particular names involved, name of the show, mm-hmm. Characters, that sort of thing.
Right. And Julie, you know, the good news about copywriting is that it's pretty easy to do. You file a very, very short application with the Library of Congress. They will take a look at it. They will figure out if there's anything that is substantially similar. If not, they give you a nice certificate. And then you get protection there for the rest of your life and then some time. So copywriting is something that really people probably don't do enough of who are creating original modes of expression, we call it.
We should have a program, I think, coming up on copywriting. We haven't done that for a while, if ever.
Yeah, and there's no doubt, because Julie brought up the idea that it's similar to another show, could run afoul of copyright laws, because the people that had that show on the air or the executive producers, et cetera, could say, well, wait a minute, Julie, we already did this. We own that idea.
Right. The test for infringement would be substantial similarity. So, you know, we always have the analogy that, you know, Shakespeare didn't have a monopoly on the idea of a young man and a young woman falling in love and killing themselves, I guess. You know, that's Romeo and Juliet, but it's also shown up in a lot of different iterations over time in other books and plays and movies, and that's because all those other versions had slightly different interpretations of just that overall concept.
Let's go to Ann in Bloomington. You're on Minnesota Law. Hello, Ann.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have it's a similar situation, although mine is a website idea. I'm in a easy terminology, and the idea is out there because I am marketing it, but it's sort of a LinkedIn for dating. So there's a specific process that users would go through to introduce one another. So you kind of bring the matchmaker into the fold and create the matches or find a match through your friends and your trusted people and your network of people who are out there. Now, obviously, anyone can introduce anyone, and so I just got some advice yesterday from a potential investor who said you should patent your idea, and I thought, well, setting up people romantically is as old as the hills, so what what part of the idea, other than you're bringing it online, could be sort of that niche that is needed in order to patent? And I do carry copyrights, a ton of them, for all kinds of things having to do with friend of a friend.
Well,
the name of the company. So,
All right, Ann. We'll let Dave get into that.
You know, Ann, I think with your issue, we would try to see if we could put a business method around that, a method that, you know, you or someone like you would be using in order to kind of have a process to run that business. And business methods are patentable. We've talked about those business methods in a couple previous shows. And so that would be a form of patenting. Now, the thing with patenting and business methods is that you have to convince the examiner that all of the prior art, so this is other things that people have previously patented or they've previously published written things about or have previously been done within the industry, collectively that forms what we call the prior art, that your business method would constitute a inventive enough step beyond what's previously been done. And if you can do that, then in principle, you would have a patentable business method that you could use to then prevent somebody else from coming along and running something in a similar manner.
You know, Dave, I think it would be fair to say that, as Ann pointed out, of course, the idea of matchmaking isn't new, not by a long shot. But I think we both agree there have been tremendous numbers of patents issued because a concept like that was converted to reality through the mechanics of the Internet, and a business method patent has issued to protect that. And maybe a common example is the Amazon checkout button,
right,
which, of course, take your shopping cart to the checkout counter is not a new idea. We've been doing that ever since grocery stores came to be, for example, yet a patent issued to protect the Amazon checkout button click method.
Right, the one-click patent, we call it, and that has had tremendous, tremendous monetary benefit for Amazon over the years. So, you know, and you're right, just the idea of matching a man and a woman together, that's been around, but it's everything else that you would be wrapping around that concept to create a business method, that is what would be patentable. And most inventions are combinations, and as long as the combination is new and non-obvious, we call it, that's good for a patent.
We have more on the way. Patent Law Changes. Tom Schroyer, Dave Beek. It is Minnesota Law. And remember, for more info on today's program and all our other shows, feel free to go online. It is Moss and Barnett on WCCO.com. We'll return in a moment. Here at News Radio 830 WCCO.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Did you know a team of Moss and Barnett attorneys worked on the appeal of the case that served as the basis for the motion picture, North Country?
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
Minnesota Law continues, presented by Moss and Barnett. Tom Schroyer, Dave Beek in studio. Patent Law Changes. Let's go to Mark on the phone lines first. Mark, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for taking this call. This deals with, I've got a food processing device in mind, and I was told by my sister-in-law that one of the ways that I can protect my idea, which I haven't refined totally, but I'm getting close, is to write as much down on paper in detail as I can and then mail it to myself and do not open it to protect my idea. And then when I've got the final process complete, then try to get a patent. But in the meantime, I'm trying to protect what I have. Is that the correct way to go?
Well, Mark, you know, writing something down and mailing it to yourself is not going to give you any kind of patentable rights. You can't use that to prevent others from practicing your invention. I think what she may have been getting at is that if you write it down and you mail it to yourself, you now have documented when you came up with that particular part of your invention. And so really it's kind of like a poor man's inventor's notebook, if you will. And so I don't think that's a bad idea. You know, you now are – one way to document when you have your invention is just filing the patent application, because now you know that as of that filing date, you certainly had that invention. But another way would certainly be to create a contemporaneous record, sign it, put it in a sealed envelope for that matter through the mail, and it shows then just through the integrity of the mail system that – you had your invention at least as of that point in time.
Let me ask a question, Dave. It's true, though, isn't it? As the caller indicates, it's important to document or to know when you came up with the invention.
Well, it's important if down the road someone else may independently come up with the same idea. And under our patent system right now this is going to change in about another year. But our system in the U.S. has historically awarded the patent to the first person to invent. And so within that context, being able to prove your invention date is really, really important, because you could win or you could lose on that issue. Now, in about a year, we will have completed the transition process where we switch over to a first-to-file type system. And so now whoever gets to the patent office door first to file will be the one to win. But now, even then, it still can be important to be able to prove your invention if, say, someone else came along and said, you copied my idea, you really aren't an inventor, you're an infringer. You would be able to pull out that documentation and say, no, I'm not, because this proves that this idea originated from me, at least as of this date, which preceded you.
All right, Dave, thank you. It's all very, very complex stuff. And, of course, very apropos to the topic we're talking about today, which is all of these changes in the patent laws are really creating quite a few layers, as it were, of additional complexity around all of these different filing and deadline issues and priority issues.
That's right. You know, we get, as patent attorneys, I guess just like anybody else, we get settled in our ways. We get used to following certain rules in applying for and obtaining patents for our clients. Those rules have really been in place for about 60 years. And we got to know them pretty well, and now we're going to have some pretty major changes that are coming along. Some are going to take effect September of this year. Others are going to take effect March of next year, so in about a year. And there'll be some substantial benefits, but there will also be some substantial watchouts that arise from those rules.
All right. We've got about a minute before the next break. If maybe one of the highlights of the changes we just want to mention is that there's a new procedure coming in place pretty soon, right, about a way to challenge the validity of a patent without going into court. We only have a few seconds here.
Okay, I'll have to be unusually insightful then. Yes, this is a post-grant opposition proceeding that we all think is going to be based on what they do in Europe. You will have a chance to file an opposition proceeding within 9 months after someone else's patent grants to challenge the validity, say the patent office got it wrong. There'll be some experts at the patent office who will hear those proceedings. And if they agree with you, then they will strike that patent down as invalid, and you'll be able to do it more quickly and at less cost through the patent office than you would have to do if you had to go through an entire court proceeding.
I understand David is 5-0 in European opposition procedures like this, Steve, so he knows what he's talking about.
We have more on the way. Tom Schroyer, Dave Beek, patent law changes. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. We might be able to squeeze in another call before we say goodbye today. Here on News Radio, 830-WCCO. Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Tom Schroyer, Dave Beek, patent law and changes. The hour has gone very quickly, and we've had a lot of great calls, and we appreciate that.
You know, Steve, it is truly the case. I wish we had another hour here with Dave Beek because there are a lot of changes. But, Dave, we want to really get out the word about, in particular, one of the changes that are looming because it's going to make a huge change for people who are in the process of getting patents.
That's right, Tom. It always amazes me how many people, inventors I talk to, they all seem to have heard about the one-year grace period to file their patent application. This has been on the books for a long time. Under U.S. patent law, it meant that an inventor could wait 1 year after he publicly disclosed or started to commercialize his invention before he had to file his application, and that provided several benefits. It gave time to the inventor to go out in the marketplace, see what the value for the invention was commercially, talk to customers, improve the invention, et cetera, before incurring the costs of preparing and filing a patent application. And unfortunately, that's going to get substantially modified in about a year here because with the new changes in the language of the law, that is going to largely go away. And so it really is going to change the rules of the game. Inventors are going to need to file their patent applications closer in time to when they really come up with their invention to make sure that then any sorts of activities by them or others made to publicize the invention, commercialize the invention, something substantially similar to it, won't cut off their patent rights.
Is there going to be any grandfathering or safe harboring of people who are already in process under the current law when the new law takes effect?
Well, I think, and this is, by the way, an extremely complicated law, so there's lots and lots of stuff in there. It seems like every time I go and look, I find something new. I think any applications that are already on file will be treated under the old rules. And it's going to be applications that are filed after that March 16, 2013 date that will be subject to the new rules so that we'll have a nice bright line there to help figure out which rules apply to which applications. But we're all checking out those very issues.
All right. Well, it's, again, a fascinating topic, and we'll have to have you back on here again to talk about further changes in patent law and also I'd like to pick your brains sometime about copyright law. I think that would be fun to do, and I think our audience would really, really appreciate that.
That would be fun, too. I'd be happy to come back and talk about it, Tom and Steve.
All right, Tom, what have we got coming up next Saturday between 11 and noon?
John Boyle returns to share his business litigation and client counseling expertise on solving ownership disputes between the owners of privately held businesses.
All right, very good. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Saturdays between 11 and noon. For more, go online, Moss and Barnett on WCCO.com.